Hello and welcome to In Control, the first podcast on control theory. Here we discuss the science of feedback, decision making, artificial intelligence, and much more. I'm your host, Alberto Padoan, live from a recording studio in Zurich. Quick thanks to our sponsors, the National Center of Competence in Research on Dependable Ubiquitous Automation, the International Federation of Automatic Control, and the IEEE Control Systems Society. Our guest today is Alberto San Giovanni Vincentelli, Edgar L. and Harold H. Butner Chair of Electrical Engineering and Computer Sciences at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome to the show, Alberto.
Thank you, Alberto.
So today we are honored to really have a true visionary in engineering. Alberto has experienced the equivalent of many lives in academic, entrepreneurial, technological innovation terms. He has a career that spans many decades, and he really has shaped the digital landscape firsthand of today. I was thinking, Alberto, of trying to give a very brief bio, condensed bio about you, just to give an idea about our audience of the legend that you are. And then maybe we can dive into your journey into research and entrepreneurship. So Alberto was born in Milan, and as I mentioned, he's a professor now, full professor, of course, at the University of California, Berkeley. He's won a number of awards that is formidable and almost difficult to list. He famously co-founded Cadence and Synopsys. So these ventures are now listed on NASDAQ with a market cap of exceeding $160 billion. He's a member of the National Academy of Engineering. He holds several honorary doctorates. He's published more than 1,000 articles and 19 books. And of course, he's well known to basically creating or contributing to creating the field of electronic design automation. So aside from this very brief bio, Alberto, I wanted to mention that we do have some things in common, among which the name, the nationality, of course, being Italian. We very importantly support the same soccer team, AC Milan, and we both did high school studies in classics and then switched to engineering. So my first question to kick off things today would be, how did, you know, growing up in Italy and having this background shape the person that you are today and also shape your career, if you wish?
Yeah, so I'm very proud of my high school studies in classics, because it was really a formative experience in the sense that studying Greek, Latin, philosophy, history, history of art, and so on, created a perspective on life, which is probably different than in other studies. In addition, when I was growing up, if you were good at school, there was no choice but to go to classics. So that was the first choice. So the best students in lower high school would go to classics. And so that in some sense is peer pressure, if you like, including my parents, but I did like the topic, so it was not a problem. But in particular, some aspect of philosophy were very important in my scientific career, especially trying to dig into the fundamentals, what I was trying to do. So I was always attracted by the reason why things work and try to figure out if there is an abstractions that allow you to understand better what is happening in nature or in technology or whatever you do in life. So I strongly support around education. So I think that being capable of growing up with classics and then switching to scientific areas later on is a good way to begin your life, because then you get a rounded education. You know the fundamentals in science, and you know the fundamentals in humanities.
I think this will be a recurring theme throughout this episode.
I hope so.
I'm sure that we'll get back to this. Personal anecdote, philosophy was my favorite subject too in high school, and I left it behind due to peer pressure as well from my parents to do engineering, which is something that lands probably a better job in principle. But I could definitely see, you know, looking at your career, the influence that these studies had on the way you think, basically, or you thought throughout your life. So maybe that's actually a good point where to start. So in your early career, I guess you could have been classified as a a person that was into systems theory and optimization. So I did some digging into the literature, and I found some of your literally first papers, one of which is called State Space Approach in Problem Solving Optimization. And I found this passage, which is quite Platonic. It says, the process of representing a problem involves necessarily a passage between two different worlds, namely the world of intuitive notion that the man has of the problem and the world of the formal and precise description of the problem that will be given to the computers. And I think this is fantastic because it really resonates from literally the start of your career throughout your journey in research.
Absolutely.
So would you identify as a system theorist, like back then and today somehow?
Well, I began actually in circuit theory, or also as it was called then, network theory, but was really circuit theory. It was not network in the sense of networking objects and communication point of view. And while I started there, I became curious about, guess what, artificial intelligence. So that paper that you quoted was actually search, in some sense, in machine learning, right? And we are talking about 1970, so 71, were my first paper. So I start trying to figure out how to formalize problems that in general are not well structured. So that was what I liked. But also I start liking computation. And so in my first works, I look at solving large scale of equations. So that was the first topic that I look at with independently from my thesis work. And that was fascinating to me, how you can improve ways of solving equations so that you could analyze systems that you couldn't do otherwise. And so I started with sparse matrices, so matrices that have many zeros, if you like, and how you exploit the structural properties. And then while I was doing this, I had the opportunity to come to the United States. Now, in the meantime, because of this work that I was doing, I was able to be quote-unquote promoted to the equivalent as associate professor at Politecnico di Milano. So I spent my first 3 years as a researcher. And then on the fourth year, I became associate professor. I was called professore incaricato, but I had tenure then. And I was asked to deepen my knowledge about research by my colleagues in Politecnico di Milano. And so they supported me to go to United States. Actually, they pushed me to go to United States for 6 months. And so in my field, this numerical aspect of a large scale system and in general simulation, Berkeley was by far number one. And so I selected to come to Berkeley. Other colleagues like my co-author in that paper that you quoted, Marco Somalvico, went to Stanford a couple of years before me because artificial intelligence then was very popular at Stanford. But I was interested in the, call it, mathematical aspect of this, so it was more interesting to go to Berkeley. So went to Berkeley.
And just to connect also to the field, so you said that your field, original field, was circuits and networks. How do the solution of those optimization problems, or actually equations, relate to apply, if you want, in the context of circuits and networks?
Well, at that point at Berkeley, there was a program that started, was called SPICE.
Uh-huh.
And that was a circuit simulator. So that was a way of shortcutting the design process in the sense that at that time, when you design an electronic circuit, people would do a breadboard and then verify if the functionality of the circuit was correct, if there was some physical effect that would make the computation wrong. Now, that was very expensive. In addition, you had no guarantee that what you were modeling with the mock-up, with the rapid prototyping board, was actually what was going on once you integrated the circuit. Thank God at that time we had a few hundred transistors. That was it, right? Not many transistors at all. And so you could see where the world was going because the Moore's Law was taking place. And so the idea was, why don't we virtualize the analysis of electronic circuit. Instead of building a breadboard and then measuring, why don't we do this on computers? Now, at that time, computers were quite lame, right? So they were not even one MIP. So one MIP is like, right now we have giga instruction per second. So, you know, it was really, we're really slow. But, you know, and not only, but we didn't have interactive terminals. So the input to debug your program for simulation was actually punch cards. So I remember going to the computer center with these punch cards and then praying that the program would compile. It's like, oh my God. Yeah, and then you could see, because you would see the computer center from large windows. And then there were two stacks, the stack of the card where they're going, that's everything okay. And the stack of cards are boom, 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 which means nothing worked. So it didn't compile. And so you were looking anxiously in which bin the punch card would go. So anyways, that heroic times.
To set the stage for the audience, this is before the personal computer, I imagine.
Oh, way before.
Way before.
Way before. Because we are talking about 75.
75.
1975.
And so I imagine, well, printed, I don't know whether we can talk about printed circuits, but they were manually designed, right?
Yes. Printed circuit and especially the integrated circuit, because printed circuit, some people started trying to do routing of the components on the printed circuit board with optimization program, discrete optimization program. So, but not on integrated circuit. So the people started saying, well, can we do it for an integrated circuit? So what I was referring before with SPICE was actually looking at the functional behavior of a circuit. So the value of voltages and currents once you manufacture them. And if this value of currents and voltages were the ones that you wanted to achieve with a chip. And of course, it's like a fractal nature of the design problem, because you could imagine that the chip is actually a shrink down of the printed circuit board. So similar problems occur at the chip level in terms of wiring together component, in terms of placing these components on a plane. So there were similar problems at all level of granularity.
Yeah, you're anticipating something that I'm really looking forward to talk about.
Yes. And that was one learning that I got, right, when we were trying to do that. But in SPICE, the idea was born by a professor at Berkeley, was Don Peterson, was actually a circuit designer.
Yep.
So he was not into equation solving and all of that. So when we met, then he asked me, please, can you give us support for the numerical analysis of SPICE? And so I helped. That's the reason why I ended up in the list of authors of SPICE.
Yeah.
Is because I was refining the algorithms. And which algorithm? Solution of linear equation, sparse matrices. And so that connected me then from the system theory angle to electronic design automation. So the solution of large scale of equation.
Yeah.
And then from linear equation like AX equal to B, which is a fundamental step in any kind of numerical analysis method, then I started thinking about what we could do to improve the part of nonlinear equation solving as well as for ordinary differential equation solving. Because in the end, an electronic circuit can be described by ordinary differential equation. And so when you analyze an electronic circuit, you have to solve ordinary differential equation. But this then, since they are nonlinear, you discretize the problem using integration method. And then once you discretize them, you have to solve static equations. So, and you solve them with Newton, Raphson, yep, in general, or derivatives of that method. And then every step of that requires a solution of linear system of equations. So the inner core routine is this equation solving. Now, for large circuit, the equation were sparse. This AX equal to B, that was the basic for solving ordinary differential equation, were sparse. And so my method or my understanding was linear equation solving help in solving the electronic circuit problem. Then we got together with Richard Newton, that was then my partner in crime, also in funding Cadence and Synopsys. And he was trying to look into the problem of simulating mixed circuits, so a mix of digital and analog circuit. And that was a very difficult problem because you have two different mathematical domains. And this also was the basis of some work that I did later on, way, way later on.
So you arrived basically in Berkeley around, so in 1976.
No, 75 actually.
1975.
So I stayed from July 75 to December 75. And I work on network theory.
And then you go back to Italy and then you come back to Berkeley. How does that work?
Then I got back to Italy because my time expired. I mean, the whole idea was that I would be there to experiment how research was done in the United States. And so I work with several professors, actually. So my kind of heroes, because I were professor where I studied in Politecnico di Milano. And, well, when it was a time to go back to Milano, which I was very happy to come back because my view of what America was pretty much from movies, right? So, you know, you look at these wonderful gardens, you know, huge gardens and these large houses and all that. When you go to Berkeley, it's not exactly like that. And so.
Very different from Milano.
Yes, I like Milano better and in general, Italy better. And my wife was from Florence and we had a young son that was 1 year old, was born in 74. So it was not the easiest period. anyway, so I said, thank God I go back to Milano. No, because then what happened is, these colleagues of mine with whom I worked, like what I was doing. And they say, why don't you come back another year as a visiting professor? And so the idea was I would come back in 76, July 76, and then do 1 year until July 77. And I say, no. My colleagues in Polytechnic will never allow me to do that, which tells you also never tell a lie, never ever. Instead, I say, no, I don't want to stay here. I want to go back. I say, no, I would love to stay here, but I cannot do that. And that was the beginning of the end in the sense that then my colleagues at Berkeley wrote to my colleagues in Milano and said, how come you don't let Alberto come back? So it's good for him and it's good for you too, because it reflects on the quality of education of Polytechnic in Milan. Without telling me, so I go back to Milano and I meet my colleagues at, and they say, oh, by the way, we granted permission. So I granted permission for what? And he said, to come back to Berkeley. Oh, no. Now, because, why? Oh, no. Because if I had to go back to Berkeley, which I did eventually, I had to teach classes in English. Plus with the, I mean, my English was high school classic
English.
Study English, which was 2 years of English and call it English. I mean, all right. So I went to night school, actually. Every day when I came back to Milano to improve my English, which it did improve, not on the accent, as you can hear now, but on the grammatical expression was slightly better. And, but the other thing is that I didn't have the faintest idea how you teach a class in the United States, and was completely different what I was used to in Milano. I was already a professor in Milano, so I was teaching classes. And was large classes. I had 400 students in my classes in Milan. And also when I was teaching in Milano, it was funny because the first class, I was about, I mean, several of my students were about my age. So when I stepped towards the stage, quote unquote, then the guy was the janitor, but we call it bidello, right? So the person was in charge of the room and would clean the blackboards and will make sure that everything was in order. Look at me and say, what are you doing? Because you had a separate entry for the professor and the student. So
oh, wow.
The professor would come in front and the poor students in the back. So he look at me and say, what are you doing here? Go back up there and say, where you belong. Okay. So I went in the student and then I marched down and I started writing on the blackboard. And you can imagine the bidello came to me and almost in tears and said, oh, professor, excuse me, you are so young. And that was the beginning of my career. Was pretty much, oh my God, you're so young. Always everything that I was doing, oh, it's impossible. He's like, why? You are too young. Okay, grant. Well, fine. And so I started teaching in, and the first week I had to teach, well, I was supposed to teach 5 classes, all different, in 3 quarters. So 2 classes per quarter plus 1 quarter, thank God, just 1 class. Okay. So I march in my first class and I sit down because there is, well, the beginning was 9 o'clock, but actually it was 9:10, right? Because it's the famous quarto d'ora accademico. Actually in Berkeley is Berkeley time, which is 10 minutes, not 15 minutes, 10 minutes. Okay. So I sat down and I didn't know it was the same as in Italy and nobody there. So I said, oh my God, nobody's going to listen to my class. So I sat down in the student session. And so the students start coming in and it was a graduate class. So one student sits next to me. His name was Joe Gray. I remember him so well, even though it was 1976. And he tells me, I don't know if I want to take this class. There is this professor with this strange long name. He must be from some European country and who knows which country. What do you think? And I say, well, I don't know. And then I stood up and started the class. We became the best friends afterwards. And so he actually was the one who told me how to teach in the United States. So because we were supposed to give homeworks. Can you imagine homeworks in Politecnico? Not in the cards, right? Then there were midterms and then there was a final exam, it was a written exam. Fine. And then I learned that. So I started doing that. But then the funny thing is that at the end, remember in Politecnico, you posted the names of people with the grades, right? So everybody was looking at the tabellone, the big table with name, last name and grade. Well, privacy, right? Wow. So in the United States, it's illegal to do that. So I posted the grades of my class outside my office. And then a colleague of mine, who had the office next to mine, comes storming into my room and says, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm posting the grades. No! You know, you go to jail. I said, what? No, no. And so it's just to give you an idea what kind of difficulties I had. So anyways, and then I thought that I did a terrible job in teaching, but at the end of the semester, then in United States, you have this grading, right? So the students grade the professors. And this is actually used to promote also. I mean, it's an important consideration in promotion if your class is liked and your teaching style is liked. So I went there and lo and behold, I was among the best. So probably the students who took pity of me and say, poor guy, he put so much effort, we have to grade him high. Well, fine. And in the meantime, I was doing also research. And so the people at my department started saying, well, gee, you should consider applying. There is a position now open in Berkeley. So why don't you apply? And I said, but I want to go back. This time I said, I want to go back. And they say, oh, fine. What you could do is you can apply, but then you fifth row. We need more people to apply. What? There were 100 people that applied to the job. And, but not in CAD. At that time it was called CAD, computer aided design. But this position was CAD in systems. So still the group was system. And, not in electronics was the system. So, okay. I said, if you need some more people in CAD, then fine, but, I would go back to Italy. And then when you apply, if you make it to the finals, quote unquote, you get invited to give a talk, research talk, and then you get interviews with the professors and then they decide whether to hire you or not. So there is a quote unquote competition. So, well, they invited all kind of people, but I didn't get an invite to give a seminar nor to talk to the faculty. I said, okay, good. Right. I'm done.
I'm going back to Italy.
I'm going back to Italy. No, wrong. So because I received this call at 11 o'clock at night from the chairman of the department saying, congratulations. After long deliberation, I said, congratulations for what? I said, you have a job. Oh no.
Amazing.
So call back to Italy and say, oh my God, you know, they offer me, what do I do? Because I wanted eventually to go back to Italy, right? And these people say, oh, don't worry. You know, if things go wrong, if you don't get tenure, because actually the interesting thing is that, of course, I was young. So I was 27. So the position that I would get was assistant professor. Well, I had tenure in Milano. And so they say, don't worry. We keep the position open for you. If you don't get tenure in the United States, you can come back here. So I had sort of safety net, but I actually resigned because I didn't like to hold on to a job that is, you know, that I was not going to.
But it was still a big gamble.
Right. And in fact, this put me in a very nice position with my colleagues because they appreciated that very much, because most of the people would not do that. But I say this, is better to do this. I think it's more honest, let's say. All right. So there when I started and.
That lands you in Berkeley. And that's why you start then interacting, I guess, Don Peterson on the Spice program.
Yes, exactly.
And that's why I noticed that on Spice version 2G, I guess. So the second version of Spice, your name appears there as well.
Your name was there. Because of the numerical analysis angle.
So then your interests shift towards computer aided design from
system. Right. But in between, you know, when I was hired, I was supposed to look at optimization problem in computer aided design, not necessarily electronics.
Okay.
So in fact, my first 2-3 years were in optimization.
Okay.
So it was non-linear, non-differentiable optimization as applied to design. And so in fact, still now I think I remember very, very well all the problems in optimization. So I liked it very much. And so at some point, this optimization work got the interest of IBM, and in particular the math department, where there was a fantastic person, Bob Brayton. And so they invited me to spend a year at IBM in 1980. And in fact, was a math department. So still from a mathematical point of view, how to solve large scale of equation, the ordinary differential equation, all this kind of nice stuff. Plus, Bob Brayton started looking into logic synthesis. So how to manipulate actually logic optimization at that time, how to manipulate Boolean equation to make them smaller and with less components. Why is that? Because if you compress this Boolean equation with the same behavior, but with less pieces, if you like, then when you go and implement that, you end up with a smaller circuit. So that was the appeal of logic synthesis. And at IBM, there were two different approaches. One was coming from computer science and one was coming from math department. So the one from computer science was again the beginning of another branch of artificial intelligence. Was called expert system. So expert system, you apply rules to manipulate this equation and see what the outcome is. But these rules were extracted by talking to designer and see what they were doing, trying to mimic what they were doing. That's the reason why they were called expert system. You interrogate the expert and then you see what happened. Our approach from the math department instead was, let's look at what are the fundamentals of Boolean optimization. And let's see if we can find algorithm, global algorithm that are not like people think. It's just different approach, if you like. And lo and behold, the first such program was a 2-level program. So to compress 2-level logic that would, at that time would be implemented in what was called programmable logic arrays. And these were very much used in all computer microprocessor. PLA was often used for the control logic of the microprocessor, including IBM. So we look at that and the program was called, guess what? Espresso. spell in Italian, espresso. And the reason why we call it espresso, besides the fact that I was involved, is because it was strong, hot, and fast.
So, amazing.
Espresso. So that was the first program. And espresso was used by everybody plus his brother. All the electronic companies, you know, from Intel to Motorola, everybody used that, which gave a very strong visibility of what we were trying to do. And so in 1983, it was a seminal moment in my career. Well, before that, actually, IBM, the math department, said, well, don't you stay here?
And everybody wants to keep you.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It means that my Italian roots are appreciated. Anyway, and so they say, stay here, please. And we triple your, they actually tripled my salary. And I say, well, and then there was a snowstorm that you wouldn't believe, right? And then my son caught pneumonia and say, wait, California, very sad. Not now, on today, raised cats and dogs, but it was sun. So I said, well, maybe not. And so I came back. But this news of the offer kind of percolated to the department. And so they kind of went non-linear. So we need to keep Alberto. And so I got promoted speed of light. So I got tenure then. But interesting enough, in a couple of years, I became full professor. So I was the fastest career ever at Berkeley.
Amazing.
Because also in 1981, 82, then I got interviewed by MIT, Stanford, University of Illinois. Because they say, why don't you come here? So that's one of the reasons. But I never use it as a leverage. I never talk to anyone. And I said, I'm going to go there because I stayed at Berkeley really nicely. So I didn't want to go. So anyway, so that's what happened then. And in 83, then I kept my contact with IBM. And in fact, Bob Brayton was, again, the person who wanted to keep me there. We start and continue work together. And so all the field of logic synthesis, as we feel of it, and as it went into Synopsys, originated from our work together. And so it's funny because many years later, I say 15 years later, then IBM was in trouble. And so they started enticing people to go into retirement early. And so Bob Brayton went into retirement, and then we hired him at Berkeley. So,
amazing.
And so we always laughed like crazy because Bob would always say, well, we try to hire you and you hire me. Say, well, guess what? So we want you here, right? Because we want to continue.
Just a quick question. So yeah. These are also the years where you met Richard Newton?
Yeah, no, with Richard Newton, I met him in 75.
Ah, and he was in Berkeley?
Because...
No.
Yeah, because he was in Berkeley. It was the first year of graduate student. Richard Newton graduated in Berkeley. And since we were about the same age, we were 2 years difference. So we would go out together and all of that.
Interact very, very closely.
Yeah.
And instead with Bob Brayton, I noted down that in the end, the results of your interactions basically coalesced into a book called Logic Minimization Algorithms for VLSI Synthesis.
VLSI Design, yes, which has been quoted more than 2,000 times. I mean, it's close to 3,000 citations.
I've actually read the preface and I found this quote that says, finally, in the acknowledgements, finally, we thank our families for their kind support during the years devoted to this effort. And we give special thank you to our Italian wife, quote unquote, whose pizza and espresso were an inspiration for this book. What does that mean?
So I pensed that when we were writing this book, and by the way, one of the authors is Kurt McMullen, and Kurt McMullen ended up winning the Field Medal in mathematics. So anyway, at that time he was a student. So it were Bob Brayton, Gary Achtel, also from IBM, myself and Kurt McMullen, was a student at Harvard in mathematics. Okay. And so the location where we wrote the book was my home in Berkeley.
Okay.
And so my wife was very good at cooking. It was while we were working like crazy, right, on the table, on the dinner table, when she would cook these pizzas and bring wonderful espressos and all of that, right? So that's the reason why it was mystery solved. And anyway, and that book actually was explaining the algorithm of espresso.
Of course, there will be links in the description for the audience. As always, we put all the links in the description. Okay, and you were mentioning that 1983 comes. I know this is a special time.
Yes, 1983 is a special time because when I was at IBM, I also looked at what they were doing in placement of gates in gate arrays, right? And so I met Dan Kirkpatrick. I was a physicist. I was in the physics department. So the interesting thing is that if you look at the foundational work in EDA, it mostly came from mathematics and physics, which is what attracts me because it's more abstract, if you like. So it's what I really enjoyed. So in some sense, I'm a bridge between the abstract world and the applied world because I found out that while I was looking at the application, I had better ideas on the algorithms and the mathematics. So I always encourage anyone who is mathematically inclined or does theory, go and talk to the designer or talk to the people who are in, you know, supposed to use your results and see what is the problem and why they are up at night. What is that could be an important solution to what they don't know how to solve. And that was the line that made my work relevant, besides the algorithms and the things and the papers and so on, and the 127H index and all that, right? Anyway, but the most important thing is the impact that you have. So looking at IBM and what they were doing, since he was Dan Kirkpatrick was a physicist, and then he was studying annealing in material, right? And then he said, well, gee, why can't I use the same? Because when you create crystals out of material, essentially you are heating the matter at a very high temperature, and then you have to cool it also slowly, and then you get a crystal. If you accelerate the cooling process, you get a glass. Now, what is the difference between a glass and a crystal? The difference is the energy level. So a crystal is the absolute minimum. So it's a global minimum of energy. A glass is a local minimum. And so if you look at most of the algorithms for discrete optimization that were used for problems that arose from circuit design, most of them, actually, I would say the majority of them, are NP complete or NP hard. If you're looking at the optimization problem, NP hard problem means that they are equivalent among each other. If you find an algorithm that is polynomially bounded for one, you find an algorithm that's polynomially bounded for all of them, which means no luck, right? So not polynomially bound. And so you have to use heuristics to try to get there. And so the problem is that you get stuck in local minima, which I knew very well because, remember, I was doing non-linear, non-differentiable optimization. And so I knew what that meant, right, and what you could do to kick out of a local minimum. And so simulated annealing was to put the cost function as if were the energy for physics. And then what you do is that you are trying to, the equivalent of temperature is to take moves like the next try of my optimization problem, my variables is going to be this. And so in general, in the greedy algorithm, you go down, or you always try to find the move that moves you the most, right? So like gradient-based techniques for optimization of continuous function. But that is what is going to get you stuck in some place, right? So you want to take also with a certain probability. You want to take moves that increase the cost function, not always decrease it. And that is the hope to get kicked out of the local minimum. And why is this temperature concept? Because when you have high temperature, it's much more likely that you are taking these steps that kick you high.
It's a random push in the wrong direction.
Basically. It's a random push. It's a random push in call it the wrong direction. In the fact of exploring better the space.
We're giving a shake to this basin.
Right. When you decrease the temperature, it means that you are less and less likely to take, quote unquote, as you say, the wrong move, right? Mm-hmm. And so in the end, you get to a, certainly a local optima, but in general is, you can see that you get to better solution than if you just take a continuous descent, right?
Yep.
Because you may not get to the ultimate, but you can get. And so I said, well, okay. So I went back to Berkeley and found a student and say, work on this. And so we work and we found this. I mean, we developed this program called Timberwolf, but also I had another student was before at IBM in the math department. And, he looked at the theory of simulated annealing. So, and I had another student come from Italy. It was looking at theory with a different angle. And so we work on the theory. So why does it work? And we work on implementing this into placement problem. So in 83, pivotal moment, I get two people outside my office and say, we'd like to talk to you. And they were from Intel. One was Albert Yu, who was the head of the microprocessor division. And the other one was Pat Gelsinger, that at that time was the head architect of the 386. And Pat Gelsinger now is the CEO of Intel. Anyway, and so he was very young at that time. And so, well, they came and said, look, we are making a big jump from the 286 to the 386. And we need to deliver a solution in 2 years. And we don't think we are going to be able to do that. It's too complex, too many transistors. So we look at, around, we look at the literature and so on, and we think that the kind of things that you do may be important to do this step. So they gave me a grant to continue developing the tools, plus they hired me as a consultant. So 1 day a week, I would go to Intel Fridays and work with them to, you know, improve the design of the 386. So they ended up using my tools for placer route, this one for simulated annealing, and then for routing was called yet another channel router, Yacker. Okay. And then they use Espresso, and then they use multi-level logic optimization. We didn't even yet publicize it because we were developing it with Bob Brayton and two of my students. Their name was Rick Rudell and Albert Wang. It ended up being among the founding group of Synopsys. Anyway, so, and they said, we don't care. You know, we are going to put together a group that is going to take your tools and we are going to make sure that there are no bugs and so on and so forth. So they did. And so actually they took a group of 20 people from Israel because Intel just opened in their offices in Israel. And they formed the nucleus of what was called the Design Technology Division. And the Design Technology Division at some point had more than 1,000 people later on.
Wow.
But in any case, because it was clear that you couldn't design without having very strong basis of tools to help you design. Well, anyway, so then I wanted to, in some of our theory papers, wanted to say this stuff has been used at Intel. And then I was prevented from doing it to say, what do you mean? You know, this is for free, open for everybody. So, you know, we didn't sell you this. So they say, no, it's too critical for our success. So it's a strategic issue for Intel. We would not give permission to quote the name of Intel. Well, guess what? At some point, Motorola used the same tools without involving, just took it down. You know, they downloaded it from Berkeley. And they designed the 68,000 with it, and they went public and said, we use the Berkeley tools. And then the day after, Intel say, sorry, we didn't mean it. So it's going to be very public now. So they had a special session at the conference. It was called ICCD, the International Conference on Computer Design. And so they went public on that. Not only, but they did a tape which I still have a copy of it. It was three of us. So it was Pat Gelsinger, myself, and the head of the project was called Hill, Gene Hill. And we were talking about the design of the 386 and the fact that they use the tools for coming from Berkeley and so on. Now, notice that Pat Gelsinger graduated from Stanford, so it was all kind of jokes about using tools from...
Because of the rivalry between...
Minor school across the bay. Yes. And say, what do you mean? Anyway. And so that was interesting because then Intel distributed that tape for every university in the world because they wanted to stress how it is possible to connect industry and university. And they wanted to show that they were really caring about research and all of that, right? But so it was doing there. But actually, it had a strong impact because then everybody kind of knew about the Berkeley tool. So the people who didn't already know. And so the other question that many people ask, say, why open domain? Why did you want to leave it open, right? You could have made so much money and say no, because it's like, I don't know if you're a fisherman, but what do you do when you go fishing is that you throw some esque, some bait, right? With no hook, right? And so fish come out, eat the bait, and I say, oh, nice, and stay there. Then you put the bait with the hook.
Amazing.
And the rest is history, right? So I always put an equivalence to the fact that we leave everything for free so that people get interested in what you do. And then you can form a company, but you know, you don't sell what you have done for the university to advance knowledge. And so, in fact, our tools have been used by every single university in the world to do their designs and also to improve upon our algorithms because they could use what we have done and build upon it. And so we think that that was really a good thing to do. And actually, my department is famous for that. So I don't know if you remember Berkeley Unix, right? Berkeley System Distribution, BSD. Right?
I was about to jump in, actually, just to say that for our audience, that the Intel 386, i386, was the first microprocessor that used a 32-bit architecture and also played a key role in the development of the Linux kernel, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Yeah. So, but I mean, the key point was that they were the basis for all the IBM PCs.
Yeah.
And this is also an interesting story because, you know, the PC as we know it today started in IBM about the time where I was there in the 80s. The first microprocessor started coming out from strange places like Osborne Computers and then Atari, you know, before the game console. And then at some point, a group of IBMers from Boca Raton, which is a small place in Florida, came up with the idea that they would like to design a PC, you know, the better than what was outside. And this was the beginning of the IBM PC 80 and then became XT. It was the most used laptop. It was not laptop yet. It was desktop computer. Anyway. And so they came to the headquarters of IBM and they asked for support. And the support they needed was the chip and was the operating system. Because they said, we can build the print circuit board, everything that goes around. But we need to spend money for this. And the IBM people looked, you know, the high ups, and they said, wait a minute, how much is going to cost us? A lot. And then if this thing is successful, what happens to our computer business? It's like the cannibalization, right? So that we cannibalize our own business. Not such a great idea. But this is cool, right? So we give you money, but not the microprocessor nor the operating system. You have to develop it on your own and find a way, right? So guess what? So they posted a request for a microprocessor. And then Intel at that time was not that big, came up and say, okay, we can sell you our microprocessor for this idea of yours. And then they did a call for the operating system. And guess what? There was this small outfit that was doing services in Boston. And guess who was there? Bill Gates and Bill Allen. And they applied to the job, right? And so they won it. And this was the beginning of the...
And the rest is history.
Of the end. The beginning of the end, in the sense that, you know, you had this small processor and you had operating system to design on a small processor. So you couldn't do very much at all on it. And so that's the reason why the MS-DOS was such a dog, right? I mean, I hated it with all my heart. But if you open the chassis of the desktop, you could see it really was a work of art, you know, because IBM engineering was the top of the top at that time. So anyway, so that was PC 80, then became PC XT. And since I was helping also there, then I ended up with a new generation of workstations that was called IBM AX. That was Unix operating system, by the way. So IBM decided to try also the Unix operating system. And so we had the actual computer in Berkeley in a secret room where my students could run the experiments for them, meaning say, well, look, you know, this doesn't work quite right. This is slow. And in fact, if you look at the tests that are used for evaluating the speed of the process for many years, it had Spice in it. It had Espresso. And in that Timberwolf. So there was a reason for it. It's because of that famous computer locked into a room.
Right? Amazing.
And also because Spice was continuous mathematics and Espresso was Boolean logic and Timberwolf was discrete optimization. So you have three examples of different mathematics that you would use there.
So it's 1983. I see that basically you contribute to this project with Intel, but also it's...
We started a company.
Exactly. That's yes. The year where SDA, Solomon Design Automation, is founded, right?
Was born. Right. So after my work at IBM, with Richard Newton, we started thinking all the kind of things that we have done. And Richard Newton was working on infrastructure for CAD. So on a unified database, a unified user interface for all the tools, because at that time we're all scattered around. And then there was an interest from companies saying, well, we have to support all the Berkeley tools and it's a lot of work, right? Because they are open domain and, you know, I cannot ask my students to support the program. I mean, that doesn't make sense. Meaning, oh, there is a bug, or maybe, how do you use it? And so every company had its own groups doing, sustaining these tools. And so the companies who were using the tools insisted that Richard and I would form a company so that the support for the tools and possibly the improvement upon the tools could be allocated in a specific place. So then it was interesting because there was a group of companies that joined together, all the semiconductor companies called SRC, the Semiconductor Research Corporation. And so they came out and said, what the heck are you doing here, you two guys? Because they were afraid that we would not leave all the tools in the open domain. And say, no, we don't want to do that. You know, the tools stay in the open domain. It's just that we want to build upon it on things that are not university research. So that's all there is. So actually, four companies were the most vocal to do this and were National Semiconductor, was General Electric that had a semiconductor division, was Harris Semiconductors, where I did a lot of consulting for them on the analog side. So on using Spice and all that. And the fourth one was Ericsson, that had also a semiconductor division. So they decided if we wanted to form the company, if we form the company, each of them would put in $1.5 million. So, which was not a small amount. We are talking about 1983.
So I guess for the time was a lot of money.
A lot. It's at least 10 times as today. So it would be like 60 million.
So were you actually aware of the actual value of what you were developing like during that time?
Well, it depends. I mean, the value is in the eyes of who is using and who is paying for things, right? So value, intrinsic value is very difficult to assess, right? So in some sense, it's not even correct to to assume something like this, especially when you do tools for something.
As a background for our audience, SDA Solomon Design Automation is the precursor of what is today Cadence.
Correct.
And the market value of Cadence today is, I checked 1 week ago and it was, I don't know if you actually checked earlier than I did.
Well, of course, I check almost every day just to, because I still have stock in Cadence, and I still founder stock even. So it was 82 billion. It was the maximum was touched, I think, 3 days ago.
$82 billion.
Right. The synopsis right there. But in any case, so SDA. And the funny thing is that the company was supposed to be called Isis, because I like, my background is a goddess of the moon, right?
Egyptian goddess. Yeah.
Absolutely. And everybody liked the name, but it was taken. So we were prevented from using Isis. In fact, the first business plan of SDA was Isis Systems. Right? So anyway, and the business plan was written by Richard Newton and myself. So we wrote the business plan. And so, in fact, when we had our 20th anniversary, I got given the book autographed by Richard Newton, Gene Solomon, and the CEO at that time was Ray Bingham, right? So as a memento of what we have done. And lo and behold, it's posted in some place in the Cadence website. But if you read it, there are certain things that we are not able to do today. So it was kind of visionary as a business plan. We're still trying to perform to the business plan. Anyway, so.
An ambitious one, for sure.
Right. And then, so at the end, we couldn't find a name. And so we ended up by saying Solomon Design Automation, because Jim Solomon came out from National Semiconductors and he said, okay, you guys, you cannot agree on who should be the CEO, because we interviewed like 100 people. Neither Richard nor I wanted to leave the university. And so, who? And then one of the companies was most vocal, National, said, okay, we let Jim Solomon leave and he will be the CEO. So, which he did. And then we went public in 1987. We had some rough times because the programs were slow to come up. And so we were losing money quite a bit. So, by the way, in addition to the 6 million, we got another couple of million from venture capitalists. So we had quite a lot of funding. Yet, we were, after 3.5 years, we were really in dear straits. But Harris Semiconductors came to the rescue. So they subscribed the increase of capital. So it kept us alive. And then Joe Costello was then a very young guy, was in charge of marketing. Larry Rosenberg was the head of engineering, and myself started thinking, how can we make something out of this situation? And we came up with the idea of partnership. So we would sell partnership to companies so that they could use our framework to put in their own tools, plus some tools that we were developing. And so we had STMicroelectronics as a partnership member. Then we had the Kawasaki Steel that started, at that time, we're starting to develop a branch in integrated circuit design. Then we had Toshiba. And then we had the fourth one, which I forget. Now, with this four partnership was enough money, because we charged quite a lot, right? To become profitable, then the tools started coming out of the company, and lo and behold, we were in business. So we decided to go public in 1987. During 1987, I went to Solomon and I said, well, look, we have this new technology, logic synthesis. Why don't we start a branch in Cadence on logic synthesis? But then the consensus at that time was too theoretical. And then you are talking about doing design automatically, not in the cards, right? The logic design is always going to be done by people. Maybe not. And so Richard and I went and said, can we form another company? So we got together with RD Geus, was at, guess where? At GE, and it was in the microelectronic division. And Synopsys was born. And similar story, we couldn't find a CEO, so finally we found one. was Harvey Jones. He was the previous CEO of a precursor EDA company. It was called Daisy System. We went bankrupt, so they disappeared. So all the original EDA company went away except Mentor, because Ken and Synopsys killed them all, right? Meaning they had so much market share that the other companies were not able to run after the tools that we were developing. So anyway, so we ended up buying one of these. It was called VLSI, a company, VLSI Technology. So we bought that as Cadence, and Daisy went bankruptcy, and Mentor is still alive. It was bought by Siemens recently.
So it was the birth of Cadence was a reverse merger, as they say, or?
Okay, so we said, okay, so we formed Synopsys. Okay, fine. Then we said, okay, we can go public with Cadence. And then we did the beauty contest of the bankers, the choice of it's called the beauty contest to find the banker, right?
So, I didn't know that.
Bankers come in and go. And so it's a beauty contest. Who is the most beautiful banker? And so, okay, beauty contest. And we selected, I mean, it was Goldman and Sachs and JP Morgan. So very large companies. They were in love with this new technology coming up into in the open market. Fine. And so guess what, though? The day in which the company was supposed to be quoted in Nasdaq was horrible, but it was the Black Monday. It was the day in which the market crashed big time. It was the worst possible situation.
October 19, 1987, that's what I see.
Exactly right.
Worldwide losses estimated at $1.7 trillion.
Exactly right. And I was at MIT at that time. It was in 1987, I spent a year at MIT.
So what did you do? Did you withdraw the offer and just did it?
We had to withdraw it, right? And so, but we did all the paperwork, right? And so, with Joe Costello, started thinking, gee, what the heck are we going to do? Right? And then there was another company that started at the same time, a little before, as SDA. And that company actually was called ECAD, Electronic Computer Aided Design, is the name of the company. But the interesting thing is that that company was supposed to be starting together with us in what then became SDA. Why? Because this person, Wang, was at Gould Semiconductors, because in the 80s, early 80s, every single company in the world was doing their own semiconductor design and manufacturing. And so he had a very good program that was doing design rule checking. So making sure that what you actually implement is what you had in mind on the layer, right? And that program was called Dracula. It's an interesting name, Dracula. But it was ready to go. It was written in Fortran. It was a write-only program, meaning that the only person who could understand it was Wang, because it was totally incomprehensible in Fortran. And he was very good in optimizing, but not commenting his code. So nobody wanted to put a finger. So anyway, and they say, but we have already a product, right? So we want to go out. And I say, well, when you made up your mind, then we can be together. Okay. So they started. But then when the time was, that finally we found the CEO and we were ready to go, then Wang said, actually the chairman of the board that he selected, his name was Glenn Anton, he said, well, look, but it's not the original relative weight, because it was supposed to be like 4/5 was going to be SDA and 1/5 was, because now we are selling and we're selling well. And so we want 3/5 of the company. And we say, no, thank you. And so the two companies stayed separated. But then when this situation happened, actually ECAD went public 6 months before us. So they were already public. So we look around and say, aha, so we cannot go public on our own, but we figure out that if you, quote unquote, merge or you acquire, I mean, it's a very fine line between the two, an existing company is quoted, then you are quoted by definition. So we did.
Okay.
And so that was in 1988, I would say. And then there was a competition to find the name of the company. And then an employee came up with this beautiful idea, Cadence, very nice sound to it. And then since then, all the name of the, of our products, not now, but Veta, were all based on music and Italian. So we had Vivace, Allegro, Virtuoso.
Hence the
and
names.
The meeting room were Torino, Milano, Roma. Anyway, so there you have it. So that was the story of Cadence going public.
And meanwhile, Synopsys had its own life somehow. So just again, for our audience, Synopsys is also another company that is in the ADA sector, electronic design automation, also worth above $80 billion, listed on NASDAQ
as well.
So it's incredible. Right. You founded two companies of approximately the same value for now. We'll see in the future, I guess.
Yes, indeed. But the other interesting thing is that we actually came very close 3 times to join forces, Cadence and Synopsys, but that remains in the hidden history of the companies because it didn't make sense that we're two companies doing exactly the same thing at that time. But actually, this is better because at least there is competition, right?
I should mention also to our audience that this fantastic story is also very detailed in a paper that you wrote on the IEEE Solid State Circuits magazine called Corsi and Ricorsi, the EDA story. I really recommend it to everyone. It's really entertaining to read firsthand from the person who did it firsthand. And also it's filled with philosophical ideas coming from Giambattista Vico.
Yes.
Another Italian Corsi and Ricorsi story. Maybe I should let you say why. Yeah, why the title Corsi and Ricorsi? Yeah.
So Giambattista Vico said that you have 3 ages that repeat themselves always equally. So the first one is the age of the gods, when people don't know what to make out of physical phenomena or whatever. So they think that is all the doing of gods, right? Then the second phase, when you come out from the age of gods, is the age of the heroes. Why is the age of the heroes? Because heroes challenge the gods and try to bring this back to principle, human, man as being the central of interest. And so you can see also in the myth, Greek myth, you have Sisyphus and, the Prometheus. So they all went into bad situations because the god took revenge. And then after the age of the heroes, then is the age of men, where reason takes over. So it's, you always try to find the reason why things are the way they are. But then you have when you reason too much, then there is no more innovation because you are stuck in this thinking, right? And then you go back to the age of gods.
Because there are new things that you don't understand.
Yes, exactly. And so you start saying, oh, there is a god that says that. Like the god of artificial intelligence now, but that's a separate story altogether. Well, anyways, and if you look at the evolution of circuit design as well as EDA, you can see that the age of the gods is the very beginning of EDA, where you did this analysis. Then the age of the heroes is when all the new ideas came forward. These mathematics-based ideas. Instead of heuristics, and that is the time when Cadence Synopsys were formed and a little bit after that. And then the age of reason, we probably still are in it, even though we are on the boundary of another revolution, call it, and it's the age of man. So if you look at the evolution in EDA and also in design methods, you pretty much the higher level of abstraction that we have been able to put together were building blocks, right? And that's it.
In fact, there's a fantastic quote in that paper where you say, if we look at the history of design methods, we see that the changes in design productivity were always associated with a rise in the level of abstraction of design capture. That's a fantastic quote.
Yeah.
And also it definitely appeals to all system theorists that I'm sure I'm listening now. It applies definitely also in our field, not necessarily just in the field of EDA.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So anyway, so then Cadence Synopsys became big companies. And so in 1988, after Synopsys was born, I had the epiphany of automotive. Why? Because the then CEO of Magneti Marelli Autronica, which is the electronic part of Magneti Marelli, the implementation of printed circuit board and assembled to provide the brain to the car. And we are talking 1988, so a long time ago. So came to Berkeley, and this guy was, we remain friends till today, very close friends. His name is Daniele Pecchini. And so in 1988, there was this idea of introducing a new way of changing gears for Formula One. Why? Because in Formula One, several races were won or lost due to the gear change, meaning Formula One had a lot of vibrations because of the speed and so on. So you wanted to have a lever that was very resistant to popping up and disengaging, because then the engine blows up. So you had to make it very, very hard. And second, you wanted to have a minimum amount of movement between one gear and the other so that the pilot could do it very quickly, right? But they had to do double clutching. So you had to synchronize the change, which is very fast, and the double clutching. So sometimes the pilots were missing the gear. And so either the engine would stop because we went too far, or the engine would blow up because you stay in neutral and then boom, right? Plus sometimes the foot was slipping. And so major disaster there as well. So the idea was, why can't we eliminate clutching and we eliminate the gear lever? Now, when we started looking into this, I went to the Formula One races, and I look at the pilots where we're coming out of the test runs, and their hands were a mess, right? Full of blood. Why? Wow. Because of how hard it was to change. So the idea is, okay, get away with the lever and get away with the clutching. So we are going to do an electronic gear switch. So you give a command, right? So at the wheel. So you don't even have to take out your hand from the wheel, and you go up and down one gear at a time, right? So you cannot make a mistake like was before. The hand, no problem, no clutching, and off you go. So, okay. Except that in 1988, the processor that were going into cars were like 8-bit microcontrollers. 8-bit is not that many, right? And so computation was kind of difficult. And the language that we used to program these microcontrollers was assembly language.
Wow.
Not really ideal to implement something that looked like a complicated control problem, right?
Yes.
So, in fact, they had this fear that there was an error somewhere. So Daniele came to Berkeley and said, can you give us a hand? And I said, well, first thing that you do, and by that time I learned that you have to raise the level of abstraction. And so the highest level of abstraction that we used at that time were finite state machine, data flow, this kind of mathematical model to describe the operation of a control. So especially finite state machine. And so I said, give me an algorithm. I was sure it was a finite state machine, right? In various states in which you have to do certain operations. And this control would change the state. It would jump from one state to the next. And I said, give me the algorithm. And he said, okay. So he went back to Torino, where the office was. And he came back with a printout that was this big, right? And say, this is the algorithm. Then I look at it, and it was all assembly language. It was actually the program, not the algorithm, was the language.
So the debugging process was to back translate from assembly to actually
a
finite state machine.
Yeah, exactly. So okay. This is what we did. So some of my students and I look at it and say, we did the back translation. It was a miserable job. And then we showed
to... I was about to ask, who went through the pain of actually back translating?
Yeah, you don't want to... Well, we had also some help from Magneti Marelli. But
okay. When
I say, see, this is an algorithm, and this is an implementation of the algorithm. So two different things. Now, if you want to debug what can go wrong, you have to look at this level of abstraction, not at the lower level, because it's too hidden. So you never... To find out what is the cause of a problem, you have to do too much work. So not a good idea. Not a good idea at all. Well, with that, we were able at least to analyze, and we found a bug. It's hidden because, again, once you have a finite state machine, you can, the brute force method is to go through all possible path inside the finite state machine. You try all input combination. And at that time, we started looking into formal verification. So trying to do this. And there was the beginning of model checking. It is very much used even today in control, right?
Yes. Model checking. So that's pretty much the principle of giving guarantees a priori about the behavior of, say, an algorithm,
exactly.
For example.
Exactly. And of course, you have to make assumptions about what the system looks like. So finite state machines, for example. If your system cannot be described that way, then you're out of luck, mostly. Not always, but anyway, so... Well, that was successful. And then after that, I collaborated. I mean, Daniele Picchini was promoted. He went into the engine control unit of Magneti Marelli. So I followed him. And that's when I started looking at design methodologies for system, not only for electronic design. It was the beginning of platform-based design. So that was the time.
This is one of the concepts that I really want to dig into in this episode because it's really fascinating.
Right. So anyway, but in parallel to Magneti Marelli, Mercedes decided to open a research center in the Bay Area. And so there was a guy, Paul Mehring, he was a German guy, of course. And he came from the research center of Mercedes and he was spending time in Berkeley 1 year, like as a visitor. And then we got together, we discussed all kind of problems because I was somewhat aware of what these problems were. And then he asked me if I could help him to write the justification why a research center made sense for Mercedes in the Silicon Valley. So I did. So, and as a consultant, I wrote that. And then they put me in this consulting group. It was called the high level group, whatever that meant. And there were four or five professors in the MIT, Berkeley, Stanford, usual crowd, right? And we were supposed to give inputs to things. And then there was an eyewitness when I was participating in this group, a very interesting situation when the Mercedes Series A at the beginning was failing on the elk maneuver. So you imagine that there is an elk in front of you and you have to steer very fast not to bump into it. So the Mercedes Series A would lose stability, would capsize.
Wow.
Right? Not good. Not good. And so, well, then they gave that problem to a research group and they found out a control algorithm that would prevent that from happening. But that was a control on the braking and suspension. And that subsystem was Bosch that was making for Mercedes. So Mercedes went to Bosch and said, please implement this because that's the way in which we prevent the capsizing of our model. So they did. But, and this is also a very important lesson, you have to be very careful how you write contracts. Because they forgot to say that the IP was property of Mercedes. And so they couldn't sell to other people this stability control super algorithm. And so they ended up giving it to BMW and others. So you can imagine, I was there when they discovered this and it was not fun because the guy who wrote the contract was not well liked. Anyway, so that's Mercedes. But then, BMW did the same thing. So I worked with Mercedes 4 years or so. And then BMW decided to open a research center here again. And there was the guy who was tasked to open this. His name was Patrick Pop. And at that time, the head of engineering was Wolfgang Reitzel. that then ended up being the shortest lived CEO of BMW known to man. But anyway, he was a real visionary, a great guy. Very tough, very, very tough, and very innovation driven. So they invited me to give a talk in Los Angeles, where they announced this opening of the thing here. All the direct report of Reitzel were there, and we started, you know, we had to judge the in various projects of BMW and then give a prize to the best project. So did that. But the funny thing is that I was assigned together with Wolfgang Reitzel. So the two of us started talking about, you know, formalization and the role of electronics and how you should look at the software design, model-driven software design, so on and so forth. So I ended up being a consultant to BMW for 5 years again, in parallel to Magneti Marelli. And there I learned all kind of lessons about the dynamics between different groups in a large company and in a most innovative car company, still now, it's number two after Tesla, in my view. And then there was this situation where they acquired Rover. And that was a losing proposition. So at some point, they decided to get rid of Rover and they decided to change CEO. And then, of course, Reitzel was the ideal person to take the new position. But then during the board meeting, it was decided that no, because Reitzel wanted to close immediately Rover, and the board, whereas there were also, as you know, in German boards, there are also trade unions. So they say, no, you cannot do that. And then he said, well, I'm not going to take the job. So they lost two top level executives the same day. But the funny thing is that in Berkeley, we were all happy. Actually, my students were all happy because they saw themselves with BMW cars. But in fact, you know, when I was doing this work for him, then he came to Silicon Valley, but I was driving an Alfa Romeo. You know, I'm Italian after all. Right?
And so these years are the 90s, like late 90s, 2000s?
Yeah. No, early, no, yes, middle 90s.
Okay.
And so he said, well, he talked to his guy, Patrick Pop, and he said, well, we cannot allow a top level consultant to BMW to drive an Alfa Romeo. And so he said, we have to put a stop to it. So they said, send the car to Albert. Right. So you know that in Europe, you can get a car. If you are a high level executive or whatever, you get a car for free, right? Leased to you. You don't own it, but it's leased to you. So here he comes. And then my friend told me, Patrick Pop said, I told Wolfgang this was not a good idea, but he sent me a Series 7 that was the top of the line. And he was telling it, Albert is not going to like this car. Let's give him something more interesting. Say, no, he's a professor, so he has to drive a Series 7. So here he comes, and I didn't like it. It was big, and it's more like a US car than a BMW. So I ended up quote-unquote, giving the keys of the car to my students, to my graduate students. And so they were kind of driving seriously. So then Patrick found out, and then he told Wolfgang, no good, right? So then they gave me a Z car. Z is a convertible car. We know the Z3, but the Z was very strong engine there. And that was designed by Vefitz. It was a research center where all the new models were designed. So it was fantastic. Not very good looking. It was not a convertible. It was actually a coupe version because the front was fantastic. The back looked like a Honda Civic. And so I say, guys, I'm going to hack it. It's very fast, but it doesn't look nice. So, okay. So then they give me the convertible version. It was fine. And then they had me test the M3. And that was an epiphany. It was such a wonderful car. Convertible again. But the M3 had this engine designed by the research center. It was just another thing. And then I tried the M5. So I tried all the models. And so, of course, I was coming to the office and I was parking in the parking garage. And then the chair of the department at some point calls me in and say, Alberto, there is something strange. Your colleague are whispering. I say, what? I say, well, you come in with with an Alfa Romeo and you still kind of come in on day, and then you come in with all these BMWs. Say, what are you doing? Are you into drugs? I say, no, I'm not into drugs. I say, oh, you sold your soul to BMW. Say, not exactly, but they are trying to convince me that their cars is better.
You were the first influencer in terms of cars.
Yes, exactly. No, they wanted just to have my opinion on the car. But it's interesting that then when Reitzel left, there was another guy who took over. It became also my friend. It was Siebert, Wolfgang Siebert, another Wolfgang. And he came to Berkeley again, and we had this wonderful conversation. And he, quote-unquote, donated a seat to the department for a new young assistant professor. So that was very well liked. So that was a marketing coup in some sense, but so long ago. Well, anyway, then Siebert ended up becoming the CEO of Conti, and then after that, the CEO of Infineon. And we still are in contact as well as with the other guys, right? And so, well, when Siebert also left BMW, then what happened is that some of the key people in BMW ended up going to General Motors. And so they talked to the top-level management of GM, and they say, we have to have Alberto in our science and technology board. Right? So, okay. So since all my friends left BMW, I don't have anybody to talk to. So, okay, I'll take the offer. So they offered me to go to this board. And I stayed there for more than 10 years. So the board actually was a three-year renewable, no more renewable with twice. But then was a time when there was the issue of security for cars. Right? It started the first hint that cars were not that secure, and then they started the interest in electrical vehicles.
And was this a time also when platform-based design was developed, or was it earlier?
No, it was after.
After, okay.
So platform-based design was started with Magneti Marelli, and then we tried to, and in fact, we applied to BMW, and then, the AUTOSAR initiative, if you look at the basic structure of AUTOSAR is platform-based design. So it did have a strong influence in what happened. And then I tried to bring it to General Motors as well. But the funny story is that 3 + 3 = 6, but I was stayed there until 11 years passed. And also after GM went into bankruptcy, remember the big problems, right? So anyway. And the reason why is because we were trying to develop a new architecture. It was called Global B, because it was the first attempt of unifying the electronics of the car. It was called Global A. And then after that, it didn't work very well because it was too much for the low-end cars and was too little for the high-end cars. Because the idea was to develop only one electronic subsystem and that would work for all cars. So my view was that we should develop not a single architecture, was too much, but the same library of blocks, but put together in a different way so that you can customize, but not customize to the point that you're redesigning the entire electronics like they were doing, and this was the principle of platform-based design. So reuse the block and develop a interconnect fabric. So that makes that simple. So that was Global B.
I'm trying to map now what you're describing to papers. I'm not sure whether I'm going to quote the correct one, so please correct me if I am wrong. But
I will.
So one is that I noted down is system-level design, orthogonalization of concerns.
Yes.
And platform-based design. Another one that I particularly like reading, it's on the proceedings of the IEEE in 2007, Quo Vadis SLD, basically details much of the concepts that we're touching on now, reasoning about the trends and challenges of system-level design. In fact, there's a fantastic quote, well, two quotes where you define what is a platform and what is an architecture. So at least the definition of platform is, a platform is defined to be a library of components that can be assembled to generate a design at that level of abstraction.
Yeah.
And instead, for the architecture, you say an architecture is a netlist that establishes how a set of components is connected.
Yes.
It is then possible to refer to an architecture as the basic structure, say, of an algorithm. Fantastic.
Yes, correct. So in fact, an architecture, you can have an architecture of a software program, you can have an architecture of an algorithm, you can have an architecture of a building, of course, but you can have an architecture of a car, you can have an architecture of electronic component of a car. And this is what I call the fractal nature of design. So the principle of design are always the same, and they repeat themselves at different level of abstraction, and they can be applied to any field. So in fact, we also applied it to synthetic biology, by the way. It's kind of interesting.
These are some of the questions that I like, because I particularly like also that thread of research. It seems like even there we are pretty much repeating history, but just in a different context, in a biological context. I did spot in another paper one of the quotes that I particularly liked. Mm-hmm. So the paper that I'm referring to is Remembering Richard on IEEE Solid State Circuits magazine. And there you write, I really have a sense that I'm back with Shockley. Shockley is famously the inventor of the transistor. I really have a sense that I'm back with Shockley and his team, as history is about to repeat itself, but this time with biology at its core rather than physics.
Exactly.
I'm very curious to hear about many things. So one, I guess, to do justice to your work, define what is platform-based design for our audience, and also its application to systems biology, and what you think about the future of that specific line of research.
Right. So in general, there are two ways in which people think of design. One is what is called top-down, and one what is called bottom-up. And the top-down is something that's very dear to academics. So you have an idea, then you go to an algorithm, then from an algorithm you go to software, and then you go to a processor or electronic components, and you design electronic components, bingo, solution, right? Which I was sympathetic to, right? So it's the kind of things that I was doing, right? So I was moving up in the hierarchy and then doing the step from the high level of the hierarchy down to the bottom level automatically, right? So I say, well, gee, yeah, this makes sense. But then I look at the first time, 88, right? So I started looking at what the people were doing at Bagnetti Marelli. And actually what they were doing is that for a new design, they started with the old design.
And then you evolve it somehow.
And then you tweak it, right? The small amount possible, smaller amount possible, because you didn't want to perturb that much, only where it was needed. And this typical bottom up. So you got something and you changed it a little bit, and you hope that things are going to go, right?
There are some recent horror stories in the aerospace domain
yes,
at Boeing.
Indeed.
And due to these reasons, I think. And yeah, let's gliss over.
Yes, let's gliss over. Too close, too in time. So anyways, but my view was, wait a minute, why can't I reuse? Because the whole point of doing what I did before as much as I can is not to waste time, quote unquote, to rebuild a new solution. And I said, well, I can try to minimize design time by reusing, instead of the entire thing, components, right? Pieces of it. Because I already done it. And if I partition the design correctly in pieces that are easy to reuse, then I can cut down the design time considerably. And also I can build a hierarchy. So I can do to the leaf of this block, the smallest blocks that I can define, then I can assemble some of this block. I have a block at higher level of the hierarchy. Then I can assemble this block higher level of the hierarchy all the way to the entire design. So I may reuse exactly the same design, right? So that is the full system as it was assembled. So this is important because sometimes people define the components at one level of the hierarchy and that's it. So they don't go down and they don't go up. Now, the point is that if you partition the reusable blocks, having blocks that are too big, then the likelihood that you are going to use this block is small. If you are at the smaller level, then it's more likely that you can use it. It's like in a building design, the bricks you can use everywhere, right? It doesn't matter what the shape is. But if you build a prefabricated wall, then you can use it only in buildings that have that particular shape. Otherwise, you can't reuse it. So this is just to give you a context where it's easier to think about stuff. So, okay, that was one. And the other side, the bigger the block that you are reusing, the faster you go to the end, right? Because you already have a large piece of a design which is already made. So I said, if that is the case, then I want to be able at every layer of abstraction to say, this is what I want to do. And these are the block of the libraries at that level of abstraction that I can use to connect together to implement that particular function. So here is a platform, is all the kind of architectures that I can build out of this basic building block. And then I'm going to choose one, and then it's a netlist and all that, one particular connection of blocks that is going to implement this. So when I move down in the level of the hierarchy, I have to choose a platform instance out of this large number of architectures which are parameterized by the library. Then what happens is that after you do this step, then you have now an architecture with blocks. Now, when you look into these blocks, the blocks are available, so all the way to implementation, then the design is over for that part. But assume that this block is actually a virtual block. So it's not, doesn't have only the, its guts are not yet. So, chosen. So what happens is that this block at this level of the hierarchy becomes a set of requirements for another step in platform-based design, because then now I have a functionality, which is what this block is supposed to do. Then I'm looking for the lower level and to see which components I can use to implement this block. And then I keep on going until all the blocks that I'm using in the design are available to me. End of story. And so this also leaves the freedom, if you like, to innovate. So you said, well, this function, I don't know how to do it. I don't have a library component for it. So no problem. I'm going to design. No problem. Problem, because it's going to take time, but I'm going to design it. And so it leaves the freedom to designers to develop something new. So innovation is there. Because at the beginning, people complain, oh, you're forcing us to use libraries and elements in a library. Say no, because you have to think that these components can be virtual. And so I had to explain that. And in that paper, it's a long discussion about it.
So you're constraining to deconstrain, basically. Your freedom from right. From choice.
From choice, right. Your freedom from choice in the sense that you have to put in precise boundaries what is the design scope. So because if you say everything is a design scope, you're never going to finish up your design. Never, ever, never. And then I look back at what I did in logic synthesis. And if you look at what logic synthesis does, you have Boolean equations and you have gates. And you want to implement this Boolean expression with gates. And now what are the gates? Are the elements of a library. And that's where the idea of library came about, calling it library, because
so you're mapping one to the other, basically.
Exactly, right. And so I said, well, gee, look, what we have done in logic synthesis is exactly one step of platform-based design, because we had a library, we composed a library, and, you know, there you go, and we realize a logic function that we had at the beginning. And so then there is, in fact, in the paper and in my ideas, there is this step of mapping, which is finding what you want to do, and you map it into what is available, and you build an architecture with the functionality embedded in it. And that embedding into the architecture is one step of the design process. Right?
Two more points that I guess also our audience in control can connect to, hopefully. I mean, one of the concepts that comes to mind when listening to you is that of also what Stephen Boyd calls discipline convex programming. So there he also forces people to restrict attention to a given set of optimization programs, But then I will guarantee to you that I give you a solution with, let's say, prescribed properties.
Exactly. Oh, by the way, just an aside, but Stephen Boyd was a student at Berkeley of PhD, and he was doing system and control.
I somehow didn't make that connection. Did you manage to interact at some point?
No, well, of course, because, you know, what happened is that Stephen took optimization from me. So in fact, when he got the body lecture at CDC, I was there. And so he pointed me as, is his fault? Because, you know, he taught me optimization and interested me into optimization. You see how connections are strange. And we are, I mean, I really have the highest esteem of Stephen. But mind you, Stephen is a theoretician, right? So yep. He likes theory and all that. But not many people know that he was also a band player. He had a band.
Yes.
And he was designing his own acoustic equipment.
Yeah, we actually did talk about it in this podcast when he
oh, really?
Joined. Yeah. So that came out. I also didn't know before talking to him directly that he had a past in rock and roll and sound engineering.
Yes. Absolutely. So anyway, and we had a program together, you know, that was not connected to the university, but I had a friend who had a large piece of land in the Sacramento River estuary. And so, and he said, gee, you know, it's a problem because we have to use lots of people to harvest in very short time. And this is not nice to people because I have to hire them and fire them because then after I harvest, what do I do? So there are these temporary workers. Plus, since I really need to do it fast, I cannot ask them to work at night. But if I had some way of automating this process, it would be fantastic, right? And we're talking early 80s, right? So when Stephen was a student. So, and I start thinking, gee, why can't I have a tractor that goes back and forth? Because in general, fields are very regular shape, right? And the point is that I can have it moving because not many, how to say, gear shift. And then you get to the end of a field and then you have to move and then you always do back and forth. The point is to find out where it is. And so we need beacons at the four corners to tell the tractors where they were. And so I said, okay, now I had Stephen in the class and I said, Stephen, there is this interesting problem that Miss friend of mine has. And say, do you want to work together on this? And I said, oh, lovely. So he came and we discussed and then, you know, we mapped down everything, every single bit, also the control algorithm and the like. But then there was a point of coding and putting it together and all of that. And so he never got around to do that. Because I wasn't able, so he had to do it. But he was able because he was a great designer of acoustic equipment, but then he had many other things to do. So it didn't work out. Now, guess what? 20 years later, he calls me up and say, Alberto, you're going to hate me. And I say, why? What did you do to me? And I say, look, there is a friend of mine down the corridor that has started a company for automatic farming. And he has made millions. And it's like, oh, really? So you hate me? I say, no, I don't. Steven, no, don't, not to worry. I don't hate you. But these are, you know, this crossing path, we, you know, it's amazing, fantastic, right? So anyway.
Very cool.
So that's the story of Stephen Boyd. And also my younger son wanted to visit different schools, right, to see where he wanted to go. And we went to Stanford and then we had dinner with Stephen, his wife and my wife and my son. And so when Stephen looked at Marco and he looked at him and said, why do you want to come to Stanford? Go to Berkeley, it's a much better place. And then he explained with you, but his father was a professor at Berkeley and he was born in Berkeley and he stayed in Berkeley until he went to Stanford as a professor. But he was saying, why do you want to go to Stanford?
Amazing.
So he ended up at a called Polytechnic, not in the United States, but now he's in Princeton. So there's a mix of things. But also the other interesting thing is that I didn't talk about this very much, but in 1987, when I was at MIT, I was among the first people working at thinking machines. And I was a fellow on thinking machine. And I remember we worked so much in parallel algorithms. And so I parallelized circuit simulation and guess what? Placement with simulated annealing. And they were two of four examples that thinking machine was giving as how to use parallel computing. I had like 10 years of research in parallel computing, but it was so horrible, so difficult to program parallel machine, still is. But in 1987 was even worse. But even if you think about how we get to where we are, right? So thinking machine was essentially, the architecture was a single bit processor. So doesn't it sound like a node of a neural network? In 1987, there was an, actually 86, 85, there was a lot of interest in neural networks and then died out. And then now we are back, right? Okay. This is about the Corsi and Ricorsi. Here we go again, Corsi and Ricorsi. It dies and then it comes back. But the how many things were tried way before now. So this thing of a tractor that was going back and forth, this autonomous driving.
You know,
the idea was the same. But we didn't have GPS, so we made a GPS, a personal GPS, by planting the poles on the corner of the field and then having a beacon to tell the tractor where it was. So same thing in the autonomous driving, you do exactly that. But also in Google Maps and so on, they use GPS signal, but it's same concept, right? Where am I, right? Which is a basic question that you have to ask whenever you do something automatically in transportation or agriculture or whatever.
Where do I go and stuff like that?
Yeah, there were ideas that took so way before it actually happened that one, again, Corsi and Ricorsi, right? So, and sometimes great ideas then don't get done because you don't have the tools to be able to do it. But then when finally you have the things that you can use, then it becomes feasible and you can open all kind of interesting new avenues.
So I think this is actually a good time to close the episode. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show. We covered a lot of ground, but I'm looking forward to resuming in the next episode our conversation. Thank you so much, Alberto, for joining us.
So thank you very much, Alberto, and I'm looking forward to interact with you on the rest of my history.
Thank you for listening. I hope you liked the show today. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider giving us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, support on Patreon or PayPal, and connect with us on social media platforms. See you next time.